Today on the podcast, I'll look back at some good movies from the first half of 2007 with film writer J. Robert Parks.
You said you really liked Waitress.
I did, yeah.
And why?
You didn't like it?
No, I did, but I wouldn't say I loved it. So.
Well, you know. This is Robert Davis, and this podcast has a story. Maybe every podcast should have a story, but this one has a story, and it goes like this. Every year, there's a big festival, film festival, in Toronto, and it's one of the best festivals in North America, maybe the best, and so it's kind of a mecca for people who are interested in film, international film especially. And I go every year. Lots of film writers and fans and critics go to see the latest crop of movies from around the world, chosen by the programmers of the festival, hundreds of movies. And last year I had this idea of trying to record just little conversations with other people who I knew who were there, bloggers and friends who I often have, you know, interesting conversations with about movies while we're there. And I thought it would be fun to just sit down with, you know, each of them for 5 minutes or something and chat. And it was a miserable failure. Maybe not for the reasons you think. It was just that, I don't know, my schedule didn't seem to overlap with everyone else's as well as it does sometimes. I was seeing a lot of the same movies, but seeing them at different times. And so when I did meet up with friends, the last thing I wanted to do was break out a recorder, you know. So I, you know, didn't end up doing it. Although I did sit down with one friend, J. Robert Parks, who's from Chicago, and we had a real nice conversation. And so I got, you know, one recorded, and it was fun, I think, for both of us. And so we decided that we're going to do this more often. And so today we're going to talk about, you know, since this is the first time that we've done this year, basically, we're going to try to recap the year and talk about some of our favorite movies. But before that, I thought it would be fun to just go back and listen to this these 10 minutes that we recorded in Toronto, because it's a little bit about the festival and about some of the movies that were playing then, which, even though it was September, a lot of those movies, some of those movies are just now coming out in cities in the U.S. So first, before I talk with J. Robert about some more recent movies, here we are, last September in Toronto. J. Robert's here from Chicago. He writes for, you'll have to remind me, but among other things, Time Out Chicago, yep. The Hyde Park Herald, yep. And
that's,
I remember,
pretty much it.
Yeah,
and my blog now.
Yeah, that's right. You have a new blog. What's your blog?
Framingdevice.org.
Right.
Which you just launched
just before.
That's right, just in time.
So I remember you, when you first mentioned that I should come to Toronto, you said that when you first get the schedule, you feel like it's another Christmas.
Yes.
Yes. Did it feel that way this year?
It does. Although I had a little bit of problems because the schedule didn't arrive until later than I thought it was supposed to. And so there was about a 3-hour moment of terror of whether the schedule would actually arrive or whether Christmas would be late. But no, there's something special about that day when the schedule arrives. You've got, you know, 300 films, and you've heard about those films beforehand because you've gotten online and seen the list. But seeing the program is different, I think, and there's just something exciting about the possibilities of TIFF. You know, the possibilities of, wow, I'm going to see 40 of these films. Now, which 40 am I going to choose? And which of those 40 are going to be great? Because some of them are going to be great, and some of them won't be.
Some of them will be lumps of coal.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's, you know, there's that old theological thing, you know, would you know if something was good unless you had the bad? And TIFF sometimes feels to me like that.
So what were you anticipating this year?
A lot of the films that played at Cannes that got good reviews, Ten Canoes, Bamako, Pan's Labyrinth, the Guillermo del Toro, yeah. Which I'm very excited about, and that comes up in a couple days. So, you know, because obviously the things that are premiering worldwide at Toronto, it's hard to know what the buzz is on that. You've got to sort of go just on a program photo or on a description or maybe a director that you like. But things that have played at Cannes or at Berlin are known quantities, and you can get a sense of, oh, this is supposed to be really good. I'm getting excited about that one.
Yeah, and Cannes is in May. Berlin is
usually in early February.
And then often we get late word from Venice, which is going on just before
TIFF. That's right. So, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, for example, the film that won the Golden Lion at Venice just over the weekend, they suddenly added a screening of that here at Toronto.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's kind of fun, and you feel like you're sort of on the cutting edge of whatever's going on.
Yeah, which was, the movie was Still Life by Jia Zhangke.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
And who has a documentary playing as well. So, and the nice thing for those of us who are here is that those films apparently are sort of paired in some way, and I don't know how, but I'm looking forward to finding out.
Yeah, me too. So what have you seen so far?
Probably the best thing I've seen is this German film called Requiem, which is based on the same true life story that inspired The Exorcism of Emily Rose, but with a much different tone, much more... it's a dramatic, intense movie, but about a young woman's struggle with sort of a dark night of the soul and how she comes through that or doesn't come through that. And I just thought it was really great. The actress won the Best Actress Prize at Berlin, and deservedly so. She's absolutely fantastic. But the editing is razor sharp, and so I really like that film a lot.
Requiem.
Yeah, which I know is coming out in Chicago this fall, so I assume that it'll be in most major cities sometime this fall for people who aren't lucky enough to come to Toronto.
Yeah, that was a movie that wasn't in my schedule, but I added it. I'll see it in a few days after your recommendation. I made room for that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'll be curious to chat. I've seen a lot of really good movies. I think that's the only movie I'd call genuinely great. But I saw this Romanian film called 1208 East of Bucharest that I thought was really fun and thoughtful. And it's more evidence that Romanian film is a cinema to watch out for.
Like The Death of Mr. Lazarescu was a movie from last year.
That's
really
right.
Great, yeah.
Yeah, that's, and the interesting thing about both of those movies, and admittedly I think I've only seen three Romanian films altogether, is they have this great dark sense of humor, and then what I called a caustic humanism. You know, it's this sense of that, it doesn't, there's not the nihilism in it that afflicts a lot of European film right now, which, to be honest, turns me off sometimes. But there's a caustic cynicism to it that I find very appealing. You know, it's but yet still a belief that people matter, which sometimes I wonder when I see certain festival films.
Yeah, I mean, The Death of Mr. Lazarescu was, it's really, you can't really put it into a category of comedy or drama because it's really so, it's blended so seamlessly that I don't know whether to laugh or cry at what's going on. It's just this comedy of ineptitude and error, and someone's life is at stake.
Yeah.
So it's like...
No, that's exactly... Yeah. I mean, and 1208 East of Bucharest doesn't have the same gravity as that, but it has the same tone in that it's about these... it takes place on the 16th anniversary of the overthrow of Nicolae Ceaușescu, and this TV talk show host wants to have a discussion of, did the revolution happen in this small town? In other words, did anyone rise up against Ceaușescu before he actually left? And so we invite these two guys, one a much older man and one a guy probably in his 40s, onto the show. And what transpires is sort of a comedy of errors, but also an interesting meditation, I think, on revolution and what the importance of politics in people's everyday life. So I like it a lot.
Unfortunately, I slept through that movie. I'm still catching up. I had four other movies that day, so I wasn't too worried about it. It was an early movie, but maybe I'll catch up with it at some point.
Yeah, I would. You know, I think that movie is Darren Hughes, who you might probably interview before the week is out, wrote, I think, in his blog that he wouldn't be surprised if that movie became very popular, just because it has a very accessible style of humor, and it's just genuinely funny. And so I could see some distributor taking a chance and trying to do something with it and being successful with it.
And that's one of the advantages of coming to a festival like Toronto, especially, but any festival, is often you'll get to see movies that don't have any other way to make it to your town.
Yeah.
You know, these are movies that don't have a distributor, meaning they don't have a way into your multiplex or whatever theater is near you. So a lot of them will be seen by distributors while they're playing here and will be picked up and they'll, you know, make the rounds, but others never, they'll fall through the cracks.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you and I live in big cities, and so we have a little bit of an advantage on a lot of other people in the U.S., but even still, I mean, there's just lots of movies that never even make it to Chicago or to San Francisco.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you and I have talked about this before, but that's part of what you do when you're putting together a program, right? You want to see some of the things that are going to be coming out this fall, so you can be part of that discussion as well. But you also want to try to catch the gem that may not ever play anywhere else. And that's also part of the joy of TIFF.
Yeah, and so there are 300 something movies showing here, 200 something of which are features.
Yep.
Many, many premieres.
Yep. Yep, and I'll see 40.
Yeah, I'm seeing roughly that many too. So when you go back to Chicago, the Chicago Film Festival will be starting soon. Are you covering that at all?
I do. Part of what I try to do at Toronto is to see at least maybe 10 to 12 movies that will play at Chicago, just so I have a head start. One of the other things I do besides freelance writing is I teach at a local college, and so that obviously gets going here in the fall, and so I have a limited amount of time to see press screenings, but I'll go back from Toronto, and within about 3 days the press screenings will start, and I'll try to see maybe another 20 of those. The sad thing is that once Chicago's festival actually begins around the 6th of October, I've seen maybe 80 movies in a month, and I'm just burnt out. And so once the press screenings are done, that's usually it for me. So I cover the festival, and I do a big write-up for the local paper I write for. But I don't actually see as many films there as I do here at Toronto.
Yeah. This is an intense experience.
It is. I mean, but part of the reason that it's so great, and what I love about Toronto is that you do get away. I sometimes compare it to summer camp a little bit, because you're getting away from the normal, and you're immersing yourself in film, and not just in watching films, but you know, you're getting together with people at lunch and at dinner, and you're talking about what you've seen. You're bumping into total strangers and having half-hour conversations about what they liked about film, and so it's a very immersive experience, which I think is really fantastic for any film fan, much less a film writer, to be part of that conversation and to see how other people are interacting with the films that you've seen and also films that, you know, you thought of seeing or may see in the future.
Yeah, totally. I remember a couple of years ago in Toronto, at the first movie I went to, it was Jean-Luc Godard's Notre Musique, Our Music. I sat down next to a woman, and she proceeded to go through her entire schedule, which was 30-some movies, for the rest of the festival. But the interesting thing was that I was also scheduled to see 40-some movies, mm-hmm. but we had almost no overlap. Yeah. That's how big the festival is. We had like two movies in common. This was one of them.
Yeah.
And then I saw her again in another one, and we compared notes. I liked the movie. She didn't. Not surprising.
Well, yes. You know, there was an old joke about Toronto that it's sort of like, you know, four blindfolded guys, you know, describing an elephant. On the other hand, you know, a lot of times you're changing your schedule based on what people have seen. You know, you were talking about, you know, getting a ticket to Requiem, yeah. You know, just because I raved about it after the first night. And I've changed my schedule based on what other people have seen. You know, it's like, you know, oh, that doesn't sound so good. Oh, but I could see that instead. Oop, you know, go change your ticket, and there you go. So,
all right, G. Robert, well, it was good to talk to you.
And thank you, Rob.
We'll catch up again maybe later in the week and see what you thought of some of the other movies.
Well, likewise. It was fun. Thank you.
Sadly, I did not catch up with J. Robert later in the week, or anyone else for that matter. I just got too tired and, you know, hung up the microphone in the closet and just watched movies, which was great. But now, let's fast forward to June 2007. Well, a lot of movies have been in theaters since we last spoke. So here to compare notes with me and talk about some of the better movies that have been in theaters this year, welcome again, J. Robert Parks.
Hello, Rob.
I've been looking forward to talking to you because I feel like there have been a lot of movies this year that I have not had a chance to sort of, well, it's my own fault for not posting to my blog as often, but that I haven't really talked to a lot of people about. But it's been a particularly strong year, sort of in a lot of fronts. I've been telling people since early this year, actually, that I feel like it's been a strong year for poignant comedies. At Sundance this year, I saw a lot of basically, you know, mainstream fare, but some that was really good, like Year of the Dog, this Mike White film with Molly Shannon, or Waitress, Adrian Shelley's Swan Song. Mm-hmm. So maybe let me ask you the question, what are some of your favorites of the year so far?
Talking about comedies, but not poignant ones, one of my favorite ones is surprisingly Hot Fuzz, which is a brilliant send-up of action movies from the same people who did Shaun of the Dead, so kind of British team, and they bring a very British sensibility to movies like Bad Boys and the old Point Break with Keanu Reeves, but it's a great film. It's very, very, very funny, and it's funny whether you're a film lover or not. I mean, some of the jokes will be particularly hilarious for film lovers who can catch the references. But that was a wonderful surprise, and I actually hope to see that again before it leaves theaters. So that's been probably my favorite comedy of the year so far.
Really? That's one that I have not seen.
It is worth your time, and I won't say anything more than that because there's a couple moments in the film where I was hoping something would happen, and it did happen, and that was so satisfying. But I won't ruin it for you. So you said you really liked Waitress.
I did, yeah.
And why?
You didn't like it?
No, I did, but okay. I wouldn't say I loved it. So.
Well, you know, my wife is expecting a baby, and so I don't know if that has clouded any of my judgment for the year. But a lot of movies this year have been really touching, and this is a movie about a woman who is pregnant and really doesn't want to be, and her life is much complicated by this fact. And what she'd really love to do is just be making pies. It's sort of the one part of her life, this oasis of her life that she enjoys. And Adrienne Shelley, the actress who I knew best from her early films with Hal Hartley. She was in his first couple of movies. But she wrote and directed this and stars, co-stars. She plays a small part in the movie, but mostly she's the writer and the director. And the way she shoots these pies are just like they're works of art, and you sort of get to see them being created. But then it's just a funny movie that is unexpected where it goes. I think it's sort of it's as if it's written by someone who knows how romantic comedies are supposed to work, and yet it doesn't want to go that route. And I liked that about it, and it sticks to its guns that way. So I really enjoyed it a lot.
I was really surprised by how good Carrie Russell was in it.
Oh, yeah.
She gives a really strong, sensitive performance, I thought, and so I was really pleased with how well she played. The only drawback for me of the film, and I realize this is intentional, is just sort of how superficial the male characters are in the movie.
Yeah. You
know, the sort of the abusive ex-husband and the super super sensitive gynecologist. That for me took a little bit away from it, but I really liked particularly the three main female characters. I think are great, and Carrie Russell's great, and you're right, it's a nice film.
And Carrie Russell is TV's Felicity, which I haven't seen, but I noticed that Adrienne Shelley used a lot of TV actors in the movie. It even has Andy Griffith, and the husband you mentioned is played by Jeremy Sisto, I believe, from 6 Feet Under. And then the woman who plays Larry David's wife in Curb Your Enthusiasm, whose name escapes me at the moment, plays another waitress at the pie diner where, where Carrie Russell's character works. But it wasn't the style of TV acting that you normally see where it's sort of bigger than life. It was, the characters are sort of caricatures, but I felt like there was a lot of subtlety there too. I agree with you about the husband. I think the gynecologist is maybe a little more complex because he does seem like he's just the super sensitive guy, but then he has some sort of unusual things going on too. So
I agree. I'm always partial to movies about regular people or even lower class people because we so rarely see that in Hollywood. And so that for me was a nice thing about the film as well.
Yeah. And another movie that I liked, it's been one of my favorites of the year that I think you liked also, is a movie from Ireland called Once.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's just a great film. I just saw this a couple weeks ago, actually. It's a musical, but not in the way we normally think of musicals. It's the main character is a singer-songwriter who plays a lot out on the streets, sort of busking. And a young woman comes up, and she really likes his music. And so they form this kind of collaboration, and their relationship is not romantic at first. And I won't give anything away, but it's not a typical romantic drama. But I thought the two main characters are just so delightful and so unexpected. And how their relationship develops and this idea of collaboration I thought was really fantastic. And the music is wonderful. It was one of those movies. I described it in a review that I may one day post on my blog if I ever get around to posting on my blog. It reminded me of those times when I have met someone sort of out of the blue, and we sat talking in a coffee shop for like hours, and we never wanted that conversation to end. That's how I felt about these characters, was that when the movie ends, it's like, oh, I would have really liked this to have gone on another hour. And it ends very beautifully, so it's not like you feel cheated, but it was the characters are so nice, and And it's such a delightful, warm, great movie. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I wrote a review of it for the June issue of Paste, and what it reminded me of is this quote from Jean-Luc Godard when he made his movie A Woman is a Woman, Une Femme est une Femme. He joked that it was like a neorealist musical. he was sort of kidding, because there are no songs in his movie. But I think Once actually is like a neorealist musical, mm-hmm. because like I almost hate to call it a musical, because it gives you this certain idea of what this movie's like, and that's not what this movie's like. These people are singing. There's music throughout, but it's because that is what they do. I mean, the guy's a busker. He writes songs and he plays songs on the street and meets this woman who also likes to do that, and so they sort of, you know, they make these songs, and that's part of their lives. No one ever breaks out into song. You know, in the stylistic way that musicals do. It's mm-hmm. definitely very realistic. And I think also its approach to the story and these characters is realistic. Like you said, mm-hmm. we sort of imagine, especially at first, a scenario for these two people and that this conversation could go on for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. But there are complications, and life doesn't really mm-hmm. work that way. And I think this movie is aware of that too. And although it is a satisfying ending, it's a complex ending. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the movie Once, definitely something that's something to check out.
It is, and for me, some of the things that I like most about the movie are little, what you might call throwaway moments in other movies. Like, near the beginning of the film, this woman, who is a little bit naive, she finds out he fixes vacuum cleaners, and so she brings him her vacuum cleaner, and for several of the first few scenes in the movie, she's just sort of dragging this vacuum cleaner through the streets.
Down the sidewalk,
and it's just, for some reason, I just loved that. There's something really beautiful about that image and what it says about her. But my favorite scene in the movie, actually, it really has nothing to do with them, but it takes place in this house where a whole bunch of people have gathered for a meal. And they're just talking, but then after the meal, they take turns playing and singing for each other. That scene could have gone on for a half hour. I loved it. So.
The two main characters are never identified by name, and in the closing credits, they're called Guy and Girl. And we should mention that the guy is played by Glenn Hansard, who is from the band The Frames, and the girl is Markita Irglova, who is someone he has actually recorded music with. So I was not familiar with this is kind of funny. I saw the movie at Sundance with Jason Killingsworth, who's the music editor for Paste Magazine and knows every band you could mention. And so afterward, I was saying, man, who were those people? They obviously are really playing. This isn't one of those lip-synced kind of things. They're really playing this stuff, and the camera just sort of there. And he said, oh, well, that's Glenn Hansard from The Frames. And I said, who is The Frames? And he had to sit me down and play all this. If anyone who likes the movie, check out The Frames. You'll like their music too.
Well, that's good to know. And another thing that I like about the film is it's obvious that they're playing the music, but the movie also has a great sense of what it means to be a musician. There's this long scene in a recording studio, this sort of, you know, marathon weekend-long recording studio. And I've spent some time in recording studios, and it felt just like that. It just really captures there's that whole feeling. It's great.
I'll say one more little thing since you mentioned a little thing that you liked about it, the vacuum cleaners, I'll mention one before we move on. There's in the story, they eventually do record something, as you mentioned, in a studio, and there's a scene after that where the guy is playing a recording of it for his father. Now, fathers of musicians in movies are not very sympathetic characters typically, but his reaction. I loved his father's reaction to the music. I'm not even going to say what it is, but it was just a very small thing. It's not a major thing in the movie, but that's something, another thing that I loved about it.
Oh, and that's so true, Rob. But it's also indicative of what's great about the movie, in that you have, you know, not a lot of secondary characters. It's mostly about these two, but the secondary characters are also rich. You know, the guy's father, the girl's mother. You know, it's a nice set of characters.
Yeah. Well, what's another movie that you've liked this year?
I've really liked, I saw Regular Lovers, the Philippe Garrel film, about 1968. I saw that, I'm not sure exactly when it's open, but I saw it earlier this year. And that is, I think, a brilliant film. It's really, I'm particularly interested in films about politics or films about history, and particularly leftist politics and leftist history. And so... That I thought was strong, and it's really striking black and white cinematography. So I like that a lot.
Did you see The Dreamers a few years ago, Bernardo Bertolucci's movie?
You know, and I did not. I missed it. I know that there's a lot of, you know, that Gorel is sort of responding to that, but I didn't see The Dreamers.
It's definitely a good counterpoint and a good double feature. They're as different as night and day, these two movies, but they're about this same period of time in Paris when people were angry about the movies and angry about world politics and about wars that were going on, and to see this sort of youthful passion both directed and misdirected was is really interesting. Yeah, I think Regular Lovers is the better movie, but they're definitely interesting to consider together. You should check it out.
Another movie I like that I know you like a lot is Sarah Polley's debut directorial feature, Away From Her.
Yeah.
With Julie Christie as a woman sort of in the early and middle stages of Alzheimer's. It's a, you know, that's a poignant film. It's a beautiful film, again, a character study. I'm drawn to these movies because we get so little of them from Hollywood. We sort of have to seek them out, and when we find them, they're like little treasures. But the portrait of Julie Christie's relationship with her husband, because about a third the way into the movie, she checks herself into a nursing home that specializes in Alzheimer's care. And that's a very difficult decision, particularly for her husband, who sort of would like to continue to care for her, even if he really isn't able to. And so I that movie is very strong. The acting is great. Sarah Polley is a great director of actors, and she has a beautiful way with kind of pale light. And Julie Christie is just luminous. She's just fantastic. I mean, I know there's a lot of, I don't really care about Oscar talk. I hope our podcast won't do much with that. But the early Oscar talk for her, I think, is well deserved.
So. Yeah, and
I don't know what your thoughts were.
Olympia Dukakis sort of rounds out this trio of excellent actors in that movie, and I agree with you. It's a really strong debut, and not something you'd expect a 20-something actress who's been in dozens of movies to do for her first time out. But she wrote this story. She wrote the screenplay based on a story by Alice Munro that was in The New Yorker. I talked to Sarah Polley a few months ago, and she told me that she doesn't feel like she really learned anything about filmmaking by being an actress, that she was never really on the set or outside of when she needed to be there, and that she wasn't involved in the key decisions sort of before and after. But when you look at this movie, I didn't want to argue with her, but when you look at this movie, yeah, the acting is so strong and confident, and that doesn't come from nowhere, you know, that I feel that she gave them that space and the opportunity to do that. But then also, just as a writer, I feel like I've read the short story, which is it's actually available online on the New Yorker's website, but it's called When the Bear Came Over the Mountain, I believe. But it's the things that she has added are very astute. There's whenever the couple is sort of spending their last moments together before Julie Christie's character goes into the home, they're dancing and they're listening to Neil Young, and the song is really it's just heartbreaking, actually. It's also an interesting choice because it's not an old song. It's a song from a decade or so ago, and I talked to her about that, and she feels like that it says something about who they were as people, that they were listening to sort of interesting music. They were progressive and engaged people, she said. And it's without giving a lot of backstory of their lives, we get hints of it all the time. And it's sort of just like Alzheimer's in some ways, that there is this fractured, foggy history that is still there and present, but mixed with the present.
Well, and that's in that sense, she does a great job of taking what makes Alice Munro's story so great, is there is this sense of how your past affects your present. And it doesn't affect it like in the ways in which a Hollywood movie does, you know, where suddenly you have this enormous flashback. But it does in very subtle ways. And it creeps in, or it seeps in at various points in time. Because when Julie Christie's character has to check herself into the nursing home, her husband has to sort of reflect on what this marriage has been and what his role has been in this marriage and what his role is in this marriage now that they're, you know, separated. And yet the movie does it with great subtlety, and it's it's very strong.
Yeah.
How about you? What else have you seen that you'd like?
Well, there are a lot of strong documentaries this year. One is one that I've mentioned on my blog in previous years. It's got sort of a, it didn't get released at all for a while, but it saw a small release earlier this year. It's called The Short Life of José Antonio Gutiérrez. Mm-hmm. It's about the first soldier who was, first American soldier killed in Iraq. And it turns out he's actually an immigrant from Guatemala. And his story is fascinating. And the movie, the way it tells his story, is just very moving. Other documentaries I've liked this year, The Ghost of Abu Ghraib, which is an HBO documentary, although it was or will be shown in theaters, I'm not sure, but it's also going to be available on HBO. It's as a documentary, it's fine, but the story that it's telling, I think, is very important and something that we've seen headlines about, but not actually seen from beginning to end. And sort of the movie tries to draw a thread of how this happened, and it's something that surprisingly I don't feel like we've examined thoroughly, you know, and this movie tries to take a step toward that.
Well, and the amazing thing, I don't know if you saw it in the papers this morning, but, you know, the general who was assigned to investigate the Abu Ghraib situation and basically, you know, implied that Donald Rumsfeld had to have known and sort of took a very hard-hitting investigation, was forced out. He's claiming this morning that, you know, he was basically forced to retire because his investigation was so thorough. Although we could probably argue how thorough it was, but I wrote in, when I reviewed Michael Winterbottom's film Road to Guantanamo, I wrote that I do think that Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo will be the defining of places of this presidency, much more so than Iraq as a whole. I think when we look back 30 years from now, we'll look at it the same way as we sort of think of My Lai, or, you know, these, you know, sort of horrible, you know, this horrible shame, and how did we let this happen? And of course, we let that happen because that's what happens in war when people are poorly supervised, and when you sort of think that ends justify means. So I haven't seen the film, but I'd like to. I think it actually opens here in Chicago next month.
It's very interesting. It's not one of the, you know, the great defining Iraq documentaries, I think, but it's certainly a very interesting film.
So are there any documentaries you've enjoyed this year?
I have. One, a very little one, which probably hasn't played in many places. It only played here in Chicago for a week. It's called Darkon. Hopefully it'll be out on DVD sometime in the near future, but it's a movie about these group of people in Baltimore who have been doing this live-action role-playing game for like 15 to 20 years. It's a little bit like what you would see at a Renaissance fair, where it's people in sort of medieval times and medieval garb, but they have created this extraordinarily intricate game where various people are part of various countries or factions, and these factions, they have a system of money, of currency. They have a battle system in which they actually sort of fight. And there's actually one amazing scene in which one group has actually built themselves a facade of a castle that another group is besieging. So that might sound like, oh man, what a bunch of geeks. But the amazing thing about the film is really about identity. And it's about why people would choose to create this sort of alter ego. And the people that they interview are really thoughtful. And they sort of understand that, it sounds like they're being geeky, and maybe there even is that aspect. But that the roles that they play, or the roles they're allowed to play in the game, give them a chance to do something different than they would get in their normal life. And it's a great documentary. It's really sharp. I've been complaining a lot in the last couple of years in the reviews I've written about documentaries, because it's become so much easier to make a documentary with digital video.
Yeah.
And yet so many documentarians don't seem to be able to get the footage they need. And so they have to have these ridiculous voiceovers to explain what they weren't able to capture on film. But the folks who made Darkon, they get all the footage they need. They've edited it in really interesting ways. And so that's a great documentary. It's both interesting from a subject matter, but it's also really well made. So that one I can recommend. It's Darkon, Darkon, one word, which is the name of the game, actually. So
I'll look for that. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, so that's one I particularly liked. So,
Well, any others that you'd like to mention? Any other films in general from this year that you'd like to mention?
Well, we should probably talk about the Guy Madden film.
Yes.
Brand Upon the Brain. This film premiered at the Toronto Film Festival last year. Did you see it at Toronto?
I didn't see it until they did the extravaganza in San Francisco in early May. So I saw it then.
Okay. And you saw it then with the full accompaniment and everything.
Right.
Okay. Which I did not. They did the extravaganza. Let me explain this. Brand Upon the Brain, Guy Madden. Great Canadian director who's fascinated is probably too light a word, but he's fascinated with silent cinema. And so his movies are often not only silent, but often he uses effects to create like really grainy footage and throws in, you know, various things to make it look like he's doing a silent film. And so what he did at Toronto, and then is repeated in a few different cities, is he made this movie, which is a silent film, but he had how big of an orchestra was it, Rob?
Gosh, I don't remember.
Okay, I mean, it's not a full orchestra though, is it?
No,
it didn't sound like it. Okay, but you know he has musical accompaniment, but he also has Foley artists who are creating various sound effects, and at least for friends who saw it in Toronto, and you can type in here too, Rob, that was one of their favorite things, was just watching the Foley artists kind of create these various effects. But it's a movie about this, I don't know how would you describe it, Rob? It's a bizarre plot. Well, go ahead. How would you describe the plot?
Well, the plot, it's a guy who returns to the lighthouse of his childhood, where he grew up. and it's mostly a flashback of his childhood there. His mother ran an orphanage, and his father was basically a mad scientist working in the basement the entire time. And just about his particular summer, one particular summer when there was a film star, a teen film star, who for some reason landed on this island. I believe it's an island where the mm-hmm. lighthouse is. So.
Yep.
I'm not sure how to take it from there, but it's obviously
well,
very, yeah.
The film star here, we'll play a tag team here. The film star is ostensibly investigating some weird thing where the orphans from this orphanage have holes in their head, and she's here to figure out why and see if sort of some devious crime is being committed.
Right.
But what happens
like a,
is
like a teen detective sort of.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very sort of Nancy Drew, Hardy Boy kind of thing. Except for this part, where the boy, the main character, is telling this in flashback, falls in love with the teen star. The teen star falls in love with his sister, and then the teen star decides to make a switch and go in drag as her brother, and therefore convinces the sister to fall in love with her or him.
Right.
And so you have this sort of bizarre love triangle going on, and then I won't give too much away because that it gets stranger and stranger, I think is fair to say.
Yeah.
With the mother and various things and the father and but for me, Guy Madden's films have been sometimes a mixed bag in that his fascinations or the just general weirdness of his films sometimes works for me and sometimes doesn't. But this time it really worked. I just thought it was really funny, but I thought it was really interesting reflection on identity and memory and how we construct our memories. And I thought the way he used sort of silent cinema motifs was really fascinating.
Yeah.
And so I think this might, if it's not my favorite, it's certainly one of my favorite of his. Why did you like it?
Yeah, I liked it for all those reasons. It's fun to sort of, I don't think I have sat down and tried to describe the plot of this movie, but it's, as with many of his plots, it's very convoluted and bizarre and moves at breakneck pace, so it's kind of hard to sum it all up. But I agree with you about it, how interesting it is. And he also makes lots of references to old and silent movies, like as the sort of teen detectives are sneaking around, they look like
the cat burglars from Fouillade's Les Vampires, or yeah. there's like references to Nosferatu with the shadow of the hands and things like that. He's definitely very aware of cinema in general. In fact, people who are interested in this movie and haven't heard the earlier podcast, I have an extensive interview with Guy Madden about Brand Upon the Brain and about lots of other movies too, so check that out on the same site where you found this. But yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I'm with you that I have sort of mixed feelings about, I never know how I'm going to respond to one of his movies. He's obviously brilliant at what he does, and there are times when I feel like I don't need it to be as long as it is. It's like Rich Candy or something, and some of the shorts that he has made, Heart of the World in particular, are just unbelievable at 6 minutes, and I think that's almost the perfect venue for him, or you know, perfect length.
Yes, I
enjoyed Saddest Music in the World, though. In fact, when I've seen it again since then, I've liked it more, I think, that, now that I sort of know what to expect. But yeah, I enjoyed Brand Upon the Brain too, and I wasn't sure how much of it was because of how it was presented. I saw it in the Castro Theater, which is this big old Art Deco movie palace, basically. But I know that he's also the soundtrack that he's recorded, and many more people will get to see it with the soundtrack. It's with Isabella Rossellini, I believe, doing the sort of extra textual narration. I'm sure that's very well done and really cool.
It is. Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I was talking with one of the film critics here in Chicago who had seen it both with and without the extravaganza. And he thought that the extravaganza was a better experience just because you really understood the importance of the sound effects. But I was I saw it just sort of with a regular soundtrack. And I was kind of happy not to notice the sound effects as much as I otherwise might have. Yeah. I think I found myself getting lost in the story more than I might have otherwise.
Yeah, I can see that. There were some fun things about seeing the effects. One example I can think of is there's a dead body at one point when its limbs are frozen because of rigor mortis in this sort of contorted state, and so they want to straighten them out. And as they do, it makes this creaking, crackling sound. Well, when you're seeing it on stage, how they do that, and these aren't like stage performers who are doing the effects. These are people who really do effects for movies, and so this is typically how a lot of these things are done. Well, the guy has this big bunch of celery that he just holds up to the microphone and twists. And it sounds like bones cracking, and it makes this horrible sound. The funny thing is how many people in the audience sort of like bristle, and you can hear this like, ugh. And it's, you know, maybe they're looking at the screen and not at the celery. It's hard to imagine that you could have that reaction to celery, but certainly if you're just looking at the screen, you would. So. But yeah, it's a very interesting movie. And just aside from the movie itself, I love the idea of making a silent movie and distributing it nationwide. It's just, that's great. That's a great idea.
It is a great idea. And apparently in Chicago, it did extremely well. I mean, both when it had the weekend of the full accompaniment, but even when it was, just a quote unquote regular movie, it's done well. So that's a good sign.
Now, other movies that we're going to talk about at some point in the future, I know you just told me that you saw Sicko, the new Michael Moore film, which I'm very eager to see, and then we'll talk about that. Another movie that J. Robert and I both liked that has belatedly played theaters in this country this year is called Killer of Sheep, which is a 30-year-old film by Charles Burnett, who is one of my favorites, and just such a great movie. That we're going to talk about that at length at some point in the future, instead of just rolling it into a little wrap up like this.
But on the other hand, if it's playing in your city now, don't miss
that's
it.
That's right.
It's just simply one of the great American films.
Yeah.
So the sad thing is, I don't know how long it'll play in various cities. You might only have a couple weeks, and so if it happens to come to your town, don't miss it.
Yeah, and then I believe it is going to be on DVD. This will be great.
Yeah, that's right.
So, do you have a DVD? Speaking of DVDs, do you have a DVD recommendation? Something that's out now?
A wonderful segue. The one that leaps to mind is Pan's Labyrinth, which I suspect for our listeners will not necessarily be a controversial suggestion, or maybe you've already seen it. But it's Guillermo del Toro, who's done some, kind of big blockbusters for Hollywood, like Hellboy, did one of my favorite movies from about 5-6 years ago called The Devil's Backbone, which was a movie about the Spanish Civil War, but also about violence, and it came out immediately in the wake of 9/11, and for me it was just a prescient film and how much it had to say about violence and about the history of violence, much more so than Cronenberg's film, actually. But what Guillermo del Toro did in light of the Iraq War is decided to make in Pan's Labyrinth a sister's movie for the brothers of Devil's Backbone. And while I don't like Pan's Labyrinth quite as much as that one, it's probably a more accessible film and a really challenging, strong film, again, dealing with this idea of violence, particularly of torture, and just how societies deal with that, how societies deal with their conflicts. But to make it, I think, more accessible for most people, there's also this fairy tale theme that runs through it. And so I like that a lot. I think it's the sort of movie that you can appreciate whether you're a cinephile or whether you're not. Although I have to tell this funny story. I have a friend who just moved from Chicago downstate here in Illinois. And Rob will know a little bit about downstate Illinois. And so he had gone into a video store actually to get Pan's Labyrinth because he wanted to rent it. And there was a big sign, a huge sign, that said, "This movie is in Spanish with subtitles. It is not in English." And then underneath it, it said, "No returns will be accepted." And my friend Mike went up to the video store clerk and just happened to remark on that sign. And the clerk said that they still got 2 or 3 phone calls a week from people who had rented it and were upset because the movie was in subtitles.
Wow.
Yes, so.
Well, watching a movie with subtitles takes a little bit of practice, and if you're not used to it, which unfortunately, because how distribution in this country works, it's not common for a lot of people to see a subtitled movie. I can understand the surprise, but it's unfortunate because it's not a difficult movie or a brainy movie to follow. It's a very it's a fairy tale for adults in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to look at, and very violent. Actually, we may want to mention. Definitely not for
it
kids.
Is.
Definitely not for kids.
No, it's not. It's a movie about torture. I mean, yeah. You and I both went to Toronto last year, and I probably saw 10 different movies in which torture was a primary theme of the film. It's no points for guessing why that might be. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but your DVD recommendation?
Mine, I think I'm going to choose a documentary called Unknown Chaplain, by Kevin Brownlow and David Gill. This is maybe an unusual choice, but here's the story with this. Back in the late 70s, Brownlow and Gill, who are these film historians who have done really great work on sort of unearthing lost stuff or making documentaries about figures who are important in the silent era, the two of them found, and there's an interesting story about how this came to be, they found a treasure trove of Chaplin material that had never been seen publicly and never been shown. Some of it was from Chaplin's own vault, so this pristine stuff that had just never been seen, and then a couple of other patches that they found, and a couple of other pockets of material that they found. But the stuff that they learned about Chaplin's process was amazing, and they made a documentary called Unknown Chaplain that looks at an outtake from City Lights, which is 9 minutes that are hard to believe anyone would cut from a movie. Or there is basically the making of one of his most famous shorts called The Immigrants from the teens, the 1918 probably. I can't remember the exact date, but somewhere around there. And it shows that he, from slate one, was just creating the film on film. So had nothing but a vague idea in slate one, and just iterates and iterates and iterates over hundreds of shots to construct one of the small masterpieces of silent cinema. And this has never been, they tried to, most of this stuff would have been incinerated, and it isn't really clear how this particular set of stuff survived. But they made just one of the most fascinating documentaries there is about Chaplin, and it's not about his life, but about his work and about stuff that he that had never been seen. But they made this years ago, and it showed on PBS as a 3-part series called Unknown Chaplain, and it was available on VHS, which I've had for a long time, but I have been waiting forever for this to be available on DVD because it's just a great thing. And it's been available for a couple of months now, but it's on DVD, and it's definitely worth checking out. Even if you're not that familiar with Chaplin, I think it's even an interesting introduction to show how some of this stuff was created. So.
Oh, wow, that's great. I hadn't even heard of that, Rob, so that's a great recommendation for me, too.
Well, J. Robert, I think this was very interesting, and I hope that going forward we will we'll try to do this a little more regularly so that we don't have such, you know, so many months to recap, and we can talk a little bit more about movies that are going to be coming out that we can recommend or just still some of our favorites.
Yeah, and it'll be fun to talk about Killer of Sheep in the next few weeks, too, because it's not only a great film, but a profound film, and it's just unbelievably exciting that it's finally coming out on DVD and people are getting a chance to see it.
All right. Well, J. Robert, enjoy the movies in Chicago.
Thank you. And you in San Francisco, Rob.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
For a list of all the films and websites mentioned in this episode, you can go to erratamag.com/podcast. That's erratamag.com. You can find J. Robert's blog at framingdevice.org. If you're thinking about attending the Toronto Film Festival, I highly recommend that you check out a website by Darren Hughes. It's called First Thursday. That's 1stthursday.blogspot.com for lots of sort of insider tips on what you can expect if you're going to the festival. If you'd like to leave feedback for this podcast, we'd love to hear your comments. Just call 415-287-4020 and leave a digital voice message. No one will answer. Next time, I'll talk with legendary filmmaker Werner Herzog about his new film Rescue Dawn with Christian Bale, plus Grizzly Man, The White Diamond, and others. That's next time. Bye.